From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. The National Climate Assessment released its third Climate Change Impacts in the United States report last month. The assessment, drawing on the work of more than 300 researchers and experts, concludes that climate change is occurring at accelerating rates and is caused by human activity. While the findings show no region in the country is exempt from adverse impacts, regions like Florida are particularly vulnerable to extreme heat events, hurricanes, and sea level rise. We'll explore the report's findings and projections and how communities can prepare. Plus, the American Association of Community Theaters World Fest returns to the Venice Theater in Sarasota this month, attracting acting troupes from around the world for a week-long series of performances and workshops. This will mark the second time the Venice Theater has been chosen to host the International Festival. We'll hear from organizers and some of the event's international participants. First, this news. From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Theater companies from around the globe will converge on Sarasota next week as the Venice Theater prepares to host the American Association of Community Theaters International Festival World Fest. We'll hear from organizers and a pair of participants coming from Italy to perform at the festival later in today's show. But first, the National Climate Assessment's third Climate Change Impacts in the United States report was released in May. The assessment concludes that the impacts of climate change are real, that they're happening at an increasing pace, and that they're human-induced. The detailed report explains that no region in the country is immune to the impacts, which include growing water scarcity in dry regions, more rainfall in wet regions, increasingly intense and more common heat events, worsening wildfire conditions, and threats to coastal communities due to rising sea levels. John P. Holdren, who heads the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, tells the Herald Tribune the report is, quote, the loudest and clearest alarm bell to date, end quote, about the need to take action addressing climate change. The release of the National Climate Assessment's findings were followed by a proposal announced earlier this month from the Obama administration aimed at combating global warming by reducing carbon emissions. The draft rule proposes a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions from power plants in Florida by about 38% within 16 years. Today, we're exploring what climate change prediction models forecast for sea level rise impacts and why Florida is particularly vulnerable to climate change. We'll also highlight how sea level rise impacts Southwest Florida's ecosystems and how preserving those ecosystems can reduce the associated risks to coastal communities. Joining me now in studio is Jim Beaver with the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council, which covers Charlotte, Collier, Glades, Hendry, Lee, and Sarasota counties. Jim, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
Also with us is Wayne Daltrey. He's a former planner for the state in Lee County and former executive director of the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council. Wayne Daltrey, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
And Laura Gesselbrag is also with us. She's a senior marine scientist with the Florida chapter of the Nature Conservancy. Her research has focused on the impacts of climate change and sea level rise on natural habitats and coastal ecosystems. Laura, it's great to connect with you again.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
And hopefully later on in the show, we'll be speaking with somebody from Everglades National Park. But until that time, I invite our listeners to join the conversation. Connect with our guests by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or post your comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. And Wayne Daltrey, I wanted to start with you. At a water resources conference I attended earlier this year, I got to speak with South Florida Marine Science Professor Dr. Gary Mitchum, who told me current predictions hold that by the year 2100, sea levels will rise somewhere between 20 and 80 centimeters. That range is based on whether or not how intensive human activity to change or reduce carbon emissions actually occurs. And this new climate assessment report projects sea level rise of between 1 and 4 feet by 2100. That's actually a little more severe than Dr. Mitchum's assessment. But overall, is there a consensus among researchers about the growing rate of sea level rise?
My reading is the consensus is that there's a consensus that their rise will occur, and they argue all over the map about how high, how fast. But what seems to be the key point of the consensus is that past estimates have always been too optimistic if you did not want high rise at all. That the more up-to-date the information is and the longer the period of inaction, the higher the water rises in a shorter period of time.
And Jim Beaver with the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council, before we really start seeing dramatic impacts from sea level rise, is there a more immediate threat of, you know, more severe flooding, particularly in areas like Southwest Florida with our lower elevation right along the coast?
We're already experiencing the effects of sea level rise in Southwest Florida. The increase in sea level, which happened over the last 100 years, which in our region has been about 8 to 9 inches, has set the stage for storm surge during tropical storms and hurricanes higher than it was before. So that's why most recently you'll see new storm surge maps indicating much further penetration of the waves that come in with a tropical storm or a hurricane than had previously been estimated. And we've had several events up and down the coast, and it's also been seen on the southeast coast of Florida, where storm surges have come in higher than they'd been previously predicted because the starting point for that surge is now higher than it previously had been.
Wow. So, you know, areas that we used to think of as inland and more, you know, safer are not necessarily so anymore.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And also we're seeing a much faster return rate on beach renourishment. It used to be you could do a beach renourishment and there'd be a longer number of years before you had to renourish again. Well, that time period's getting shorter and shorter.
And that's, of course, as we all know, an expensive proposition in and of itself. And, you know, besides risk to human life, can we really enumerate the toll climate change and sea level rise impacts are having or could have on Florida's future, given our ever-important tourism and agriculture industries?
Yes, that is very possible to do. We've done it in our vulnerability assessment for the region, which we completed in 2009. That's for all of the counties in the region and goes up the Peace River and the Myakka River as well. For specific adaptation plans, we've been able to calculate financially what the impacts of different climate change effects have been for the city of Punta Gorda, for all of Lee County, and selectively, as I've been asked to do different studies, I'm able to show this and how it can change through times, not only in terms of economic costs to real estate, to road building, but also to ecosystem services.
Right. And, you know, as we've already said before, you know, we shouldn't necessarily be talking about future tense. The impacts of sea level rise are already occurring here. We've seen that with our region's salt marsh habitats. They've moved in the last half century or so.
That's correct. In the 3-year study that we did on salt marshes for the Charlotte Harbor area, we've been able to show they moved inland about the length of a football field between 1954 and today.
And you know, let's think about impacts to roadways as well. When it comes to future transportation infrastructure planning, do we really need to take accommodating changes due to sea level rise into account?
Yes. And we're able to show in Lee County and also Charlotte County did some good work with Florida State University identifying which roadways are most in threat and which ones now need to be looked at in terms of either elevation or reinforcement. A prime example of this is the Sanibel Causeway. Even though the bridges that go out to Sanibel are high enough to deal with many years of sea level rise, the causeways and the approaches are much lower. And so they're more in threat from earlier sea level rise effects.
We're taking a closer look at the impacts of climate change and sea level rise in the coming years and decades and how coastal communities can prepare for adverse impacts. We're speaking with Jim Beaver of the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council, retired state and Lee County planner Wayne Daltrey, and marine scientist Laura Gesselbracht with the Nature Conservancy. Join our conversation with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Jim, so much of our infrastructure in Southwest Florida here is situated right along the coast at some of the most coveted and sought-after properties. But in terms of future infrastructure development, do you predict that perception will change? Chairman of the Geological Sciences Department at the University of Miami, Harold Wanlis, recently told the PBS NewsHour that some properties, and he's talking primarily about the Miami Beach area, properties being purchased today won't be able to be sold at the end of a 30-year mortgage. Do you think that situation is that severe for locations here in Southwest Florida?
Well, I don't make real estate predictions.
Sure.
But what I can say is that within our region, the majority of the high-value real estate is in the tropical storm surge zone. Mm-hmm. And basically, many places are already experiencing undermining. People are looking for reinforcements on their areas. And a good example of what to expect, you can go down to the Cape Romano area, and you can see the houses that were built on those islands, which are in the 10,000 islands, which are now being lapped at by the Gulf of Mexico, which had many areas, a large area beach in front of them just 20 years ago. So it's, I can't say what the value of these things are going to be, but the fact of the matter that history has shown us through historical time is as the shoreline moves, people will move as the shoreline moves. Mm-hmm. So it's possible that we will see the type of things Dr. Wallace is talking about.
And Wayne Daltrey, I believe you were on the program we'd had a while back when we were talking about everything going on with the federal government and the national flood insurance program. Do you think we'll be seeing more issues like that in the future as well?
Oh, yes. Of course, you have the congressional debate on the existence of climate change, and that will continue as long as money flows towards the deniers. The real problem we're seeing is that the public resource, as you alluded at the very introductory comments, water is becoming more and more scarce as those sea levels rise. For us, for example, all those canals funded by the feds, the state, and locally for roadways serve to drain the lands. And when you take the pressure of fresh water off the land, the salt water intrusion moves further inland. And when your sea levels are rising, so is the salt water intrusion level. In our area, even we have abundant rainfall in part of the season, unless we store the water within the land as groundwater, the salt water intrusion just moves in, and there are no plants that can go from freshwater to salt water based root systems. We just end up with more desertification.
Hmm. And, you know, I was reading about, information going on in the Miami area looking at the impacts and severity of saltwater intrusion. Is that a paramount concern here in Southwest Florida, Wayne?
I'd say we learn a lot from Miami on the things we do and shouldn't do, and this is another example. Too much development on the shore, and given the nature of the rise, it only takes a foot or so to make the barrier islands less inhabitable, make the near shoreline less desirable. So, yes, we're going to experience that too.
Actually, we are experiencing it.
Yes, Jim. We were experiencing it when we brought it up 25 years ago.
Indeed. And so the Lower West Coast Water Supply Plan is identifying that most public water supplies are going to be moving to salinated aquifers to a large extent and have to use desalinization in the future.
A more expensive energy source in an era when energy supplies are becoming scarcer, yes.
Mm-hmm. Just in terms of, all of this water, do we really need to invest more in maintaining a functioning stormwater drainage systems in our communities here in Southwest Florida? Better infrastructure there?
We definitely need to maintain stormwater infrastructure to the degree that usually isn't thought of, which is to keep fresh water and not get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. And Jim, let's turn to the city of Punta Gorda in Charlotte County, which, as I understand, is really kind of a regional leader in terms of efforts to prepare for rising sea levels. What have officials in Punta Gorda been doing that maybe other cities in our region could take note of?
Well, they were the first city to work with us on putting together an adaptation plan for climate change. They adopted it, and they're implementing it. So the nine main areas they decided to work on, they're implementing on seven of those nine right now. They've increased the coverage of the seagrass beds. They're now working with the Nature Conservancy with Laura's program on working on an oyster bar construction, a living shoreline. They've adopted a fertilizer ordinance to reduce the nitrogen and phosphorus going into the ecosystem, which helps with the ecosystem's recovery against climate change. They've changed their building codes to improve the way the city's being built. So after Hurricane Charlie, they're building better than they did before. And they are indeed improving that drainage system, as you had mentioned, and putting flap gates so they don't have back tide occurring up through their storm drains. Mm-hmm. And their whole city plan involves a managed relocation. so that, for example, when their public works facility reached the end of life, rather than building it in place in a vulnerable area, they built a new location much further inland, better protected from sea level rise and storm effects.
And Laura Gesselbrecht with the Nature Conservancy, this would be a great time to bring you into the conversation. Jim was just talking about some of that, those, I'm going to call them natural resource infrastructure work that's been going on in the Charlotte Harbor area. But when we talk about risks associated with sea level rise, what sorts of natural resources are we talking about in terms of things that can help reduce risks?
Yes, well, all of our coastal habitats have some risk reduction capabilities, some more than others. For example, our tide flats can help reduce some of the energy coming in on storm surge. But as far as reducing wind energy associated with tropical storms, things like mangrove forests have been proven not only in the Charlotte Harbor region, but elsewhere in the world have had significant positive impacts in reducing the wind energy associated with hurricanes and storm surge. Some communities in some of the tropical island nations in the Pacific, in areas where there were no mangroves, whole village areas were destroyed. Where mangroves were present, structures remained. So we're seeing this again and again. And so protecting our coastal habitats is very important in the Charlotte Harbor area. A lot of work has already gone forth over the last 30, maybe 40 years to protect some of the existing habitats. So they're unlike many other areas in Florida, they're still large, intact mangrove forests and other coastal habitats in Charlotte Harbor, which help protect the adjacent developed areas. But not only are they valuable for what they do to protect our human communities, but also serve a huge role in keeping the environment healthy and vibrant. And people that live in the area also benefit from that. Charlotte Harbor is known as one of the major sport fishing areas in Florida, and a big reason that is possible is because of our coastal habitats in the area that provide food and shelter for young fish and even adult fish and help those populations thrive.
And Laura, give us some examples of some of the top things that communities can do to protect our natural resources that might be compromised by sea level rise, but that could also help us, you know, deal with those adverse impacts also.
Yes, well, I think key to that, and I just mentioned it, was protection. So first of all, preventing those coastal habitats from being developed. That's a really important step, and a lot of work has been done there. Secondly, restoring coastal habitats that have been compromised for one reason or another. And what goes along with that is good management of those natural resources. So some of those restoration and management measures might involve removing invasive exotic species or restoring or maintaining natural flows of water through the system. When I talk about restoration, over time, certain habitats in particular have been diminished more so than others. And although they are not uplands, they can certainly help protect some of our upland and coastal wetland systems. And what I'm talking about are living shorelines, and in particular, oyster reefs placed in front of some of our shorelines to help reduce some of the erosion that is increased as a result of sea level rise. So, for example, in a project we're working at Tribune Harbor Walk in the city of Punta Gorda, we are in the process of placing oyster reef in front of an existing mangrove forest. And over time, as that reef grows, it can help slow some of the water movement in the area that can help support that reef longer than would be possible without that reef there. And oyster reef in the Charlotte Harbor system has been greatly diminished over time as a result of using some of the reef material for roadbeds, and perhaps excessive harvesting of the oysters over many decades. And it's not unique to the Charlotte Harbor system, but in many areas of the country and the world where oysters were prevalent, the shells, once the oysters were shucked, the shells were not replaced back into the system, which would have helped to protect those healthy reefs. So we're facing that now in many areas in Charlotte Harbor as well.
Well, Barbara in Fort Myers emailed us a question, relating to, beach shoreline and beach renourishment, as we talked about earlier. And she writes, while some areas do lose beaches and shoreline, aren't there areas where accretion occurs? How do you know beach erosion is not being caused by man-made alterations like jetties, water releases, et cetera?
We do have areas where accretion is occurring. It's typically where the sand's leaving the eroding part of the beach and going to. And those are areas which have not been built up. It's interesting, you can look along a map of the coast of the Gulf Coast of Florida, and you will see that the accreting areas are the places like Cay Acosta, where there is no construction, the ends of islands where there is not the hardening. Man-made structures like seawalls, jetties, and groins do accelerate the loss of beaches, but we do know from measurements that the actual tide line is now higher here than it was before. So these two factors working together, many things have a synergy. So construction by humans along with the sea level rise are accelerating the loss of beaches.
And some of the accretion is occurring underwater because the water table, the sea level is now higher.
I see. Laura, I wanted to just turn back to you for a minute. You've extensively studied coastal wetland systems and impacts of sea level rise in your study titled Modeling and Abating the Impacts of Sea Level Rise on 5 Significant Estuarine Systems in the Gulf of Mexico. Can you tell us about that study and what some of the key findings were?
Yes, well, we know sea level is rising. We don't know exactly how fast. So we looked at several different sea level rise scenarios. And the goal behind the study was to better understand how our coastal habitats were changing in certain areas. And by better knowing how our systems were changing, we could take actions that would be most beneficial to protect not only the natural systems over time, but also the human communities that are adjacent to these systems. So we looked at, in Florida, we looked at 5 different estuary systems, Pensacola Bay, Apalachicola Bay, the Southern Big Bend, which extends from about Alligator Harbor, not too far from Tallahassee, down to just north of Tampa Bay, and also the Tampa Bay system, as well as Charlotte Harbor system. So we looked at how these coastal habitats might change, where developed areas get in the way of coastal habitats migrating to higher elevations as sea level rises, and to better understand where, what habitats are most at risk and also how the distribution of those habitats might change. And by doing that study, we can better understand what species are most vulnerable to the changes underway, what areas of certain coastal communities are most vulnerable, and that would be where the coastal habitats are disappearing. So the end point of the study was really to get people in the community, stakeholders, natural resource managers, scientists, politicians, community leaders, more aware of what changes were taking place, and getting them more engaged in developing solutions that can help abate those problems. So some of the findings that came out of our study were, let's not keep investing in highly vulnerable areas by redeveloping over and over again as perhaps tropical storms come in and take those properties out, reduce their either destroy them or reduce their value significantly. It's better, of course, to rebuild in less vulnerable areas. And Jim touched on some of that earlier in talking about the city of Punta Gorda and how they're dealing with adaptation to sea level rise. The other thing is to allow the coastal habitats to move upslope where possible, to keep the systems as healthy as possible and to continue to provide that protective capacity that those coastal habitats provide to adjacent built areas. Looking at maintaining freshwater flows and sediment inputs to our coastal habitats, because that can help maintain them over time. Without sediments coming into these systems, there's really limited ability for them to increase in elevation and help reduce the impacts of sea level rise. Some of our coastal habitats in a moderate level of sea level rise are able to keep up. Things like mangrove forests and some of our salt marshes are able to keep up if the conditions are right. So helping to maintain those conditions would be helpful. And then also looking at the species that are most vulnerable. Are there things we can do to help them get through bottlenecks that might be that they may be experiencing in the future, anticipating that? For example, in places like Tampa Bay and the Charlotte Harbor area, tidal flats are at risk. They are likely to diminish greatly as sea level rises. So what does that mean for our wading birds and other coastal birds that utilize these habitats? Is there a way that we can provide them with the habitat they need as our coastal habitats change? So those are some of the things that came out of our study. I think probably most interesting and most important, some of the recommendations coming out from the the people in the communities that participated in our study was the need to educate people at all levels, at all ages, in all sectors about what is happening to our coastal communities, both our human communities and our natural communities, so that people better understand and can take appropriate action.
Laura, when you bring this information, or when other folks at the Nature Conservancy bring this data to stakeholders, policymakers, do you have a receptive audience?
I think very receptive. I almost think surprisingly receptive, because we weren't debating what the cause of sea level rise was.
Sure.
We just talked about this is what's happening. It could happen at variety of rates, and let's look at a variety of rates so that people can understand. And we're really looking at what the trajectory is. What are the changes that we can anticipate, and trying to get people ready for those changes. And by being more knowledgeable about what the changes could be, people can look for those changes over time to see if they're happening. And I think, you know, everyone that participated is all for good planning, good management. And doing it early certainly is a big financial savings than trying to retrofit or do something after a large event has happened, like a hurricane or a huge storm surge event. So,
right. Ounce of prevention, pound of cure, right?
Yes, exactly.
despite this consensus we talked about earlier regarding, you know, the reality of human-induced climate change, there are still many skeptics out there, and they include some high-ranking public officials. Florida's own U.S. Senator Marco Rubio has said, quote, "I do not believe that human activity is causing these dramatic changes to our climate the way that scientists are portraying it," end quote. Former Governor Jeb Bush, Governor Rick Scott, and other GOP officials share that view. Jim and Wayne, does it concern you that as a society we're still having this debate?
Well, I don't think it's as a society we're having this debate. I think it's become a political point for a certain fraction of a certain political party. The way I like to say it to people is that when it comes to climate change, that belief is optional, but participation is mandatory.
Right.
It doesn't matter whether you believe in it. You have to confront the actual damages and the effects which are occurring. We are in climate change. We've got sea level rise documented. It's happening. We've got wetter wet seasons, drier dry seasons. There's more 90-degree days over the past 100 years than previously. We're seeing climate instability. That's another thing people need to understand, why I use the term climate change rather than global warming. We are going to have colder colds as well during this instable period, because if you look at the geologic record, as climate changes, things get more unusual in between steady states of climate. Okay. Also, the rate really depends upon how much other factors occur and where you are. The rate of sea level rise here in southwest Florida is different than in southeast Florida, and it's much more rapid in places like the mouth of the Mississippi River where their land is sinking. Mm-hmm. So you always have to look at relative sea level rise. And so the things that Laura are talking about, where we have a river like the Peace River, which continues the sediment load, puts lots of good fresh water at the right times of year down and doesn't have this odd freshwater delivery like the Caloosahatchee, the mangroves are being able to keep pace with our current rate of sea level rise. But in the long term, if rates increase, if, for example, the ice sheets come off of Greenland or they come off of Antarctica, then the rate could exceed what we're able to deal with. And that's why we need the migratory corridors for habitats. So essentially the plant communities will move landward as the sea level rises through these areas we've preserved, like the Charlotte Harbor Buffer Preserves, our state parks, and areas where we have wildlife corridors.
And getting to the point about the deniers, first off, if they just didn't believe people were causing it, they could still support a program of reacting to what would be a natural change. But as long as economic best interests continue to have people think they're better off by doing nothing than doing something, we're going to have deniers. Unfortunately, as Jim pointed out, participation is mandatory. And for some, the participation may be a discussion point. For others, it's a matter of life and death.
I would just add, there's a great book called Collapse that's authored by Jared Diamond. And it's all about how humans throughout history have ignored signs that we were pointed in the direction of great peril and ignored it, oftentimes for political reasons. And so it really helps people understand why we might not be taking action now.
And, again, officials like Senator Marco Rubio have come out against this new draft rule from the Obama administration, came out June 2nd, aimed at cutting down on greenhouse gas emissions. There's a complicated formula, so the percentages are different for every state. But, again, they give the states a lot of flexibility in how they would go about cutting down their greenhouse gas emissions, things like perhaps instituting a cap-and-trade system, maybe getting a renewable energy standard in Florida. But Senator Rubio has said, again, as long as countries like China continue to produce greenhouse gases at the rate that they do, we don't need to be taking steps that are going to so adversely hurt our economy.
He does not believe in leadership by example, then, does he?
That would be I was just about to ask for a response. Jim, did you want to add anything to that?
Well, yeah, basically, while he may take that position, it really many others are taking the position who are Republicans in our community who are adapting for climate change, who are working on mitigation plans. The city of Naples has a whole plan they put together which has saved the city cost of energy. It's financially to their benefit to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Lee County is doing the same. So you have to wonder the motivation for opposition to programs which save money for America.
And I'd like to add, I really applaud all of the businesses and major corporations that have taken action on reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. Again, for financial reasons, it saves money, as well as to show leadership. I think it's wonderful.
Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, so we'll have to leave it there. But I want to thank my guests, Jim Beaver with the Southwest Florida Regional Planning Council. Thanks for joining us in studio.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much also to Laura Gesselbrecht. She's with the Nature Conservancy, senior marine scientist there. Thanks so much again, Laura. Good to talk to you.
Really appreciate it.
And also thanks to retired state and Lee County planner Wayne Daltrey for your insights this morning as well. Always good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, theater troupes from around the world will converge on Sarasota this month as the Venice Theater prepares to once again host the American Association of Community Theaters International Festival. We'll hear from event organizers and performers traveling a great distance to take part. That conversation's just ahead Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.